Imagine knowing exactly what your students are learning and exactly which steps you need to take next.
Join us in Download the Reading Quiz to craft meaningful and productive formative assessments that move away from gotcha moments of basic recall and toward assessing what your students actually can do.
In this 30-minute free masterclass, we'll share three powerful assessment keys that work for any novel at any time of the year.
Head to shop.bravenewteaching.com/masterclass to sign up, and we'll also send you a free workbook to keep track of all your notes.
Once again, that's shop.bravenewteaching.com/masterclass to nail formative assessments forever.
Well, hello and welcome back to Brave New Teaching, and welcome to our final author interview for Camp BNT Volume 1. I've decided that this is a yearly thing now. Amanda's just laughing at me. Hi, everyone.
We will be sending out a survey to make sure that you all want it to be a thing, but listen, we're feeling like you do.
After you hear today's interview, if you have not already been convinced that talking to authors and talking to the artists that we love and that our students like can't get enough of, if you listen, I've lost the beginning of that sentence because there were too many commas. It's okay. Just listen. It's gonna be good. We have a really good interview for you today, people.
Yes.
Like a really good interview with author extraordinaire, Elizabeth Acevedo. She was so kind to take time. We even talked over our time and went into like another meeting. She had to like text them to be like, hey, just give me 1 second. Cause we were like, could we also do an extended interview for our happy hour listeners? Because they would really love it. And she was like, yeah, totally. Hold on. Give me a sec. We were like,
also, I don't think I took a screenshot of the video, or maybe we still have the video. We need to share with everybody, with her permission, her book situation, like her background was so cute.
Yes. Let's talk on an audio platform about the visuals, shall we? So,
okay. I know everyone listening loves a good book display. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. We need to get a screenshot of it where she's not like making an awkward face.
We'll just ask her to send a picture of her book display, because it was on so strings, cute. Right? And they were all
hanging
down, at almost like, you know, at Target when you go in the dorm section and there's the like twinkle lights with the clips for pictures.
Yes.
It was like that, but legit and for books. And it was so cool.
Yes. I loved it. That was like the most. And then at points I was just staring at her, like not staring at her. All right.
Yes, you were. It's fine.
Listening to her.
This is a safe space. You were staring.
They were mesmerizing. Like the books, I was kind of like, I felt like my head kept kind of turning at an angle.
Every time she would like move her head, I'd be like, oh, look at that one. Like, oh, look at that book behind her. Yeah.
But we love Elizabeth Acevedo. We have loved her work for a very long time. And getting the chance to talk to her on the podcast was so special. We just really thought it would be it was wonderful for us, but it's a gift to you, our listeners. I mean, you, and I'm going to say this, it's going to sound really corny, but genuinely, Marie and I started this podcast in January of 2020 is when we first started, December of 2019, we started recording. And we just really began this out of a love for what we do, a desire to create a space for teachers who were like-minded and wanted to have these conversations and weren't getting them otherwise. And you have stuck around. A lot of you have been here since the beginning. You have joined us and you have left reviews. You have done things to help us grow in a way that we were able to get an interview with someone that I know you all want to hear from too. So thank you for being part of that, because you genuinely were part of that.
No, absolutely. And I mean, there is not a more deserving audience than teachers and educators at large, because I mean, as much as watching things like Teacher Gram and Teacher Talk, there's a lot of let's gang up on administration. Let's make fun of things that our supervisors do that are like, remember your why. I'm all like, yes, I'm all for some good-hearted poking fun at, and also like pointing out disparities, et cetera. But education is not, in general, is not for the faint of heart. And there are no more deserving audience members for something like so cool than educators. And so we are inclusive when we are talking about educators, even when we talk specifically about classroom applications. I do want to read some of her bio, because I feel like I'll flub it up if I don't read it. But we had the opportunity to really talk about her upcoming, or maybe by the time this comes out, I can't remember the exact date of the release. I think so too, of her new adult novel. She's entering into a new foray. She told us in the interview, she's not done with YA, but this is her first publication in like the adult fiction world. And it's called Family Lore. And it is a multi-generational story that is just, it's magical. I mean, I've said this before on some of these episodes. We're not on this podcast to tell you about the things that we don't like. So when we don't like things, we often don't bring them up, right? We like just don't talk about them because there's enough negativity in the freaking world. But also, we want to bring you things that we genuinely like so that you can get excited the way that we do. And this novel is one of those things. And also just hearing from the brain that thought this up is also one of those things. So I'm going to read from the bio on the back of the book so that I don't, again, screw it up. Elizabeth, yo, too late.
Already?
And that was reading. Elizabeth Acevedo is the New York Times bestselling author of The Poet X, which won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. She is also the author of With the Fire on High, one of Marie's favorite books. It doesn't say that on the back of her book, but it could. Named a best book of the year by New York Public Library, NPR, and Publishers Weekly, and Clap When You Land, which was a Kirkus Prize finalist. She holds a BA in Performing Arts from the George Washington University and an MFA in Creative Writing from the University of Maryland. She resides in Washington, D.C. with her love and their sweet little baby. I know. I added that part too. And you'll find out more about her career path that took her into becoming an internationally recognized and award-winning writer. I'm excited for you all to hear this interview today.
Yep, it's amazing. We talk about Family Lore, but I think the best treat comes right at the beginning. You're going to get a private audience with Liz reading from Clap When You Land. The very first, like first chapter Friday, that's one of my favorite parts, is hearing her read her own work is so cool.
Yeah, no, it is, because you get all the right pauses and all the right intonation. Yes, it's wonderful. All right, friends, enjoy today's interview. Come on back next week. We will debrief it and talk about how and when and where and why we will be using these works in our classrooms. And we can't wait to hear what you think. Enjoy.
You're listening to Brave New Teaching, and we are so much more than a podcast.
We give teachers the inspiration, support, and tools to challenge the status quo.
I'm Amanda, and I'm a former English teacher from Illinois.
And I'm Marie, and I'm a teacher from Southern California.
Join us at bravenewteaching.com to find out more about our courses, festivals, and get every episode's show notes.
We're so glad you're here. Enjoy the show. Brave New Teaching community, we are absolutely overjoyed to welcome author Elizabeth Acevedo to the Brave New Teaching podcast. Welcome. We are so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to speak with you.
Yay!
Amanda. Well,
yes, Marie.
I was just going to say, do you want to get started with, okay, listen, I'm a little flustered. We were just talking before we started recording about how Amanda has switched to water and I'm still on coffee, and maybe Amanda had the right idea. Okay. I'm a little spazzy right now, everybody. That's okay. Well, so we were explaining before we all started recording here for our listeners, just kind of the gist of what we're doing with Camp Brave New Teaching this week, our summer series. If you're coming to us in real time, you are very much part of it. We hope that you continue on and keep listening to this whole series with authors. And if you're not like in real time, you're coming back to this at a later time, this is a whole series full of amazing authors with very clear voices that are writing for like we can see all of these in the hands of our students. And that is really what has brought this group together. And we are just delighted to talk to you today about both your new book that is coming out. In fact, I think by the time this podcast episode launches, it is on the shelves, Family Lore. I'm excited to talk to you about that. And then I've just been a big fan of your YA forever as well. So yay, we're here.
I can't wait. Let's do it.
Liz, are we going to call you Liz? Is that what people call you?
Yeah, please call me Liz.
Oh my word. Okay, well, Liz, so why don't we begin with just you giving a quick little backstory of like what you are doing on this planet with writing. For those people who don't know you, let's
just
hear
quick,
in your words.
Just quick, what no are you pressure. Doing on this just planet? Quick. It's just, you know.
What is your purpose here?
Uh-huh. Why were you sent here?
And we are recording. Right. Mm-hmm, go.
Oh, I don't think there's a satisfying answer to that. What am I doing with writing? I think I've known since I was really small that I had stories to tell and that I wanted to preserve memory. Mm. And for me, writing is a way to preserve thoughts and feelings and human experiences, either shielded as fiction, repurposed as fiction, or accessible kind of more directly as poetry. And for me, it is about how do we think through what it means to be human and what it means to have so many things we go through that feel uniquely to us. And then you read it and you're like, oh, I'm not alone. Right? I didn't know anyone else had gone through that or felt that. And there is my experience in a way that doesn't make you less unique, but does make you feel less lonely.
Sure. I love
we
that.
We get that.
Yeah.
I mean, that is reportedly, I'd say one of the things that I think when kids come to us with books that they loved, that's what they say was the point of connection was exactly what you just described.
Well, yeah. The number of students that I've had come up to me after reading With the Fire on High, because that's I probably have 15 copies of that in my classroom and it can't stay on the shelf. They come up and they go, I haven't had a baby, but I just really connected. Like they're shocked that they connect with it, with a character with whom they don't have, I mean, other than proximity and age and some similar experiences, they have very little in common often, but there's a quality and an authenticity, I think, to the characters that they just, it resonates with kids. And that is something that is very special. I mean, I think I told you before we started recording that I just finished my 16th year teaching. And so I've seen a lot of books come through. And there are some voices that are really that powerful. And students can smell bullshit from 6 miles away.
Yeah,
like teenagers, they can sniff it right out. And so if they know that something is written kind of like tongue in cheek for them versus written for them, they're going to go towards the latter, and they come back to it again and again. And I think that's very special.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think that is one of the things I most try to pursue is how you hold young people with tenderness in your work, but also with, you know, an unflinching honesty because they recognize that. And I think they know when they're not being held as well. Like when you come like, oh, I'm just not going to at all let you know I love you. I think they can sense that too. Like, oh, I don't know that you were thinking of me as a human who's going to really have deep feelings about this book. And so trying to hold them in that way, but then also like, I hear you and I'm going to say it the way I know you can hear me.
Sure.
They get that. And just like you said, they think they need that so authentically in their lives. And actually, so one of the things we like to do and one of our practices that is very honored at the podcast and with teachers nowadays is we love to do this thing. It's called First Chapter Friday. It's one of the ways that we have found to expose new books to students quickly. And so we would love it if you would give us a little clip of maybe not a full first chapter, but maybe the first page of either We Can Do Family Lore or whatever favorite. You've got them all hanging right there. So
I know. I'm like, where I knew these questions. I saw them in advance and I was like, I have to read. Make sure you pick the book. And then I'm like, wait, which one am I going to do? I think I'll read from Clap When You Land since, you know, the Poetics exist in so many forms. And people have heard me read from that. And With the Fire on High, I often read from as well. But this will be a kind of shorter clip. Clap When You Land is the story of two sisters who don't know about each other. Their father had a secret family, and then their father dies in a plane crash, and they learn how to process grief, but also how to process these new gains as well, what it means to find family and lose family. And this first page is in the voice of Camino, because it toggles back and forth between the two sisters. And Camino is a sister who lives in the Dominican Republic. I know too much of mud. I know that when a street doesn't have sidewalks and water rises to flood the tile floors of your home, learning mud is learning the language of survival. I know too much of mud. How Thea will snap at you with a dish rag if you track it inside. How you need to raise the bed during hurricane season. How mud will dry and cling stubbornly to a shoe or a wall to viralata the dog and your exposed foot. I know there's mud that splatters as a motoconcho drives past. Mud that suctions and slurps at the high heels of the working girls I once went to school with. Mud that softens, unravels into a road leading nowhere. And mud got a mind of its own, wants to unwrap your penny loafers, hug up on your uniform skirt, press kisses to your knees and make you slip down to meet it. Don't let it stain you, Diaz always said. But can't she see? This place we're from already has its prints on me. I spend nights wiping clean the bottoms of my feet, soiled rag over a bucket, undoing this mark of place. To be from this barrio is to be made of this earth and clay, dirt packed, water backed, third world smacked, they say. The soil beneath a country's nail, they say. I love my home, but it might be a sinkhole, trying to feast, quicksand, mouth pried open. I hunger for stable ground somewhere else.
Oh my gosh.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm really glad I didn't interrupt you, because I was about to say, I know this is the mud poem, because I teach this poem, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you picked that one. So this one, personifying mud. Oh my word. Where did this come from? And how did you get here? I love it.
Yeah. You know, the story of Clap When You Land is kind of interesting. I had known for a long time I wanted to write something in response or thinking about flight AA-587, which was a flight in 2001 on its way from JFK Airport in New York to the Dominican Republic that crashed in Queens. The flight was 90% Dominican. So it was huge, right? It kind of rocked the Dominican community in New York. And then all these stories started coming out about people who had been on the plane and what they were returning back to DR for, and what, you know, secrets started coming out, hopes, dreams, just all the things humans carry with them and lose when they die. And so I knew I wanted to write about that. And I wrote the entire novel from the perspective of Yahaira, which is the sister in New York. You didn't get the second perspective. And I remember talking with the author, Ibi Zaboy, who wrote American Street, Pride. She has a new novel that'll be coming out this summer. And we were represented by the same agent, and we were at a retreat, and we're like roommates, and we're chatting about what we're working on. And I'm like, I'm writing this novel, but there's something missing. Like, the heart is missing. I wrote, you know, at that point, the entire thing. I'm like, but I can't figure out, there's like a texture. And she goes, you need the other sister. Like, you need the sibling. Like, you write this whole book about this sibling who is ignored or forgotten or not talked about or a secret. And then they're a secret in the book. Right. And literally that day I sat down and I wrote the poem Mud, which ended up being the first poem. And Camino's character hijacked the novel. Like, she just became so interesting to write, so exciting. I had to kind of revise and rethink the entire book because she was so compelling. I had to get Yahaira to match all this verve that she came with. And so it's funny that poem ends up being the poem to kind of invite readers into the text, because it was kind of the way that I found my way into the real heart of the story.
So I have a follow-up question that has, we're kind of going to go segue here, but my teacher brain is activated because teaching writing, and this past few years I've taught primarily seniors, getting them to revise their own writing, even when they come up with a better idea, is like molasses in a snowstorm. Like, it's just stuck, just nowhere. We're not going anywhere. Can I ask you about, what did it take? Was it just like inspiration that fueled you? Or what did it take to take a novel that was almost completely written, and then one voice goes, well, what if you wrote the other half? And you were like, oh, like how, what was that like?
No, that was exactly my reaction. Yeah. It's the hard, I mean, you have, you know, the novels in verse tend to be a little bit shorter than a novel in prose. And so you have 35, 40,000 words from one perspective, and you realize, oh, half of this has to go. And not only half of this has to go, but what's here needs to open up to, right, to this other thing, this other character that is now going to be co-telling the story, right? And of course, I dragged my feet and I, well, maybe I can make it work this way. Maybe I can, you know, I really wanted to figure out how to make the vision I already had work, but it wouldn't have served the novel, right? And so I think I knew at that point, this was Clap When You Land should have been my second book, but I knew what it would take for me to get it where it needed to be.
Yeah.
Needed time. And so, you know, I know that students hate revising. And I think sometimes it's because the reason they are submitting something in the first place is like, I just need to get the assignment done.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. And when there's not that passion behind, oh, but I need to get the assignment done to my standard, to my satisfaction, to what I know is possible. And I won't get another shot to write this story in this way. Once it's published, I can't, oh, well, now I can do it better. Let me rewrite. Yeah. You know, like you very rarely can like do that. And I know some writers, I'm thinking of Kiese Leiman, who is very staunchly committed to revision it and will reissue, you know, newer editions of his work, of his novels, of his writing. But I think for the most part, a lot of us know, like, once it's published, it's done. And so I wonder how maybe teachers can establish a standard of writing or some type of commitment to a writer's work within students so that it's not, oh, I'm just revising this because you're telling me, so I'm going to change a couple of words and like fix that comma. But really, like, have I arrived at the best vision of this? If this is the only way I can write this thing, this piece of writing,
yeah,
is this what is my best? And I think that would take a lot of pre-work early on in the school year and just like finding each student's you know, standard and getting them to kind of stick to it. But it's hard, you know, it's hard. And I think it might be helpful for them to know, like, even for professional writers, like, it's hard to look at a thing and be like, oh no,
like, what have I done?
I gotta redo the whole thing. Yeah.
We're trying. I think that there's a lot of, and that's kind of why we invited you here, right? I mean, and I think what Marie and I are trying to help people start the conversation, because I think that's where it begins, is how do we continue to reward process over product? And how do we, you know, I think it's by having the conversation more often is a big first step.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and I mean, when you talk about your stories too, like Clap When You Land, that it just wouldn't have been right. And you wouldn't have been doing the characters justice, that integrity behind it. It's part of our challenge as educators is finding the thing that students care about to respect that integrity, right? Like it's a doozy. It's a lot.
Because we're talking about intrinsic, right? Like it's like, how do I tap into what intrinsically inspires you and gets you to want to make the best thing possible for yourself, right? And not just your English teacher is going to be the only person who sees it and is going to grade it and is, oh, I really want an A, or I really want, you know, and that's hard, I think, to establish a culture of that self-motivation. And so for sure, I don't envy, you know, trying to figure that out. And with each year, I'm sure it's like a new set of challenges.
I will say post quarantine, like post COVID quarantine, it has been a new set of challenges for sure. Like there's just a different energy that's coming out of kiddos. But like, I mean, to bring it kind of full circle in our conversation, bringing in characters that they can connect with, like those in your books, like there are certain kids that connect so strongly, like I was saying before with Imani, and like they then start to soften themselves a bit to allow themselves to feel and allow themselves to recognize out loud what they care about. And that is a huge step in that process.
I've noticed similarly when I do events at schools, I think that we're in a recalibration. You know, that isolation was a kind of trauma for a lot of our young people. All the loss of whether it was, you know, eighth grade promotion or you know, the transition from elementary school to middle school, from middle school to high school. Mm-hmm. I think your friends, your whole ecosystem, your teachers, actual, you know, loss of people. I don't know that we are fully processed. And I think young people for sure are not fully processed. And so there is a way that we're going to probably be in this thing for a bit. And it must take so much empathy. For me, it has taken a lot of empathy to not try to show up with the same kind of approach that I did prior to quarantine. And like, I'm going to do my thing. And this is what I expect of you. And then I had students who were like, oh, I've actually never been at an assembly because I missed this many years of high school. So I've never sat in a room with this many kids. And I'm like, oh, actually, we're going to start all the way at square one. This is how a presentation goes. Like, I had to reshift.
You have that moment of like, here's our social contract. I will speak.
Yeah.
You will listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you can ask me questions and I'm going to answer them. I know. And it's the simple things that we understand because we have so much memory and it's just like baked into us. Oh, my sweet little students, seniors this year. Yeah. I was like, oh, y'all are messy. Woo.
Yeah. And And we don't know how long it's going to take or what it's going to look like for this generation. And I think it's just real. So, you know, thankfully, the books that were written before the quarantine still seem to have resonance. And hopefully that's a part of like recalibrating or getting back is like, can you open yourself up to text to other characters?
Yeah.
But it's hard.
But it is a connection in some ways. Even a book that was written in 2019 is a connection with history because the world is so different.
Yeah.
Right? It's connecting with history. It's the before times. Yes.
Exactly. It was before the Poetex and then there was before quarantine. So modern history. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Curriculum Rehab by us, the team here at Brave New Teaching. It is the first and only teacher PD of its kind, a course to help teachers like you by guiding you through creating your own personal framework for curriculum. You make it work for you, your students, and your unique situation because nobody else knows what the kiddos in your classroom need the way that you do. Curriculum Rehab takes all of the resources available to you, all of the lessons, the assessments, the activities, all of the texts, everything that could possibly be there for you, and it helps you organize what you actually need in order to attain your teaching objectives. These are the strategies that Amanda and myself have used in our own classrooms, have developed over very long years of teaching and figuring things out, combined together to create this framework and these strategies that we can guide you through. This course will give you the tools you need for a complete curriculum overhaul or to start from scratch. Wherever you are on that continuum, it does it all for you and with you on your timeline. So start today, do a little bit more in a couple of months, and then pick it up next summer. It's teacher PD the way it should be, on your own time. Head to curriculumrehab.com/course for more information, or just head to the show notes for this episode. We cannot wait to see you there. It's finally time to take control of what goes on in your own classroom and create the curriculum of your dreams. All right, let's get back into the show.
Okay, so speaking of Poetex, can I go on, Marie? Are we ready?
Please do. Yes, okay. I'm here for this.
So we've all kind of established, right? We love all of your novels in verse. They're amazing. They're life-changing, students especially. I never grew up with novels in verse from Hispanic authors that like could tell these stories. Like I just didn't grow up with that. And it's definitely changing lives. But I'm curious about what on earth compelled you to step outside. What was going so well for you and get into the adult fiction world and bring us family lore? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think I never want to be pigeonholed into a particular kind of storytelling. For me, I want to tell stories that feel important, and I don't want to have to feel like, oh, that's not for me to tell because I only write young adult fiction. And I've been wanting to write an adult novel for a long time, and specifically, you know, this novel of these sisters and these women who are all trying to figure out what's true. What's the truth when you have kind of ensemble truth telling, or when your memories are corroborated by other people, or you're not sure how to express what you feel or think, and so people make up truth for you? What does that look like? And so I knew this was not the kind of text that was going to work for young adults, not only because three of the characters are in their 70s, but the weightiness of some of what they're writing about, I think, required me to shift, knowing, okay, my audience is mature, and so I can be a little bit more gloves off, right? And I think I just mentioned, like, I think with young people, I want to write with tenderness. I try to hold, particularly for young people of color, there are so many negative messages about who they are that I'm really mindful at all times of portrayals of young people, of how I hold them, of will they feel loved by this book. I think that is a little different with an adult novel. I can kind of step back and be okay that it might, there will be tenderness, but there's also going to be a reflection of some of the harder things and questions that may not be answered, easily answered. And then I'm going to challenge the reader, you know, on a structural level, on a craft level, to have to do some work that with a young person, I know, well, oh, if I do a shift to a different point of view and a completely different character, and it's their seventh character in the book, like, they might not be here with me. Right. And I think with adults, I'm a little bit more mindful, like, you might not be here with me, and that's your work. Like, I have done my work, hopefully. And so you have to do part of it as well. So adult felt like the next shift. And this felt like the story that needed to happen at this point in time. I feel like I have a nice collection for young people, and I could take a beat and move for a different audience. I'm going to write for young people again. I mean, I'm already writing for young people. The next thing, I'm always writing the next thing. So I have not abandoned, you know, the teens.
I mean, I will say, like, it's cognitive work, even for somebody that reads like insane amounts of books, because I just do it. I do find myself leaning into YA quite a bit because I'm reading for my students. I was absolutely reading for myself, but I can still picture like six kiddos who just graduated last week who would absolutely devour, because they have those literary minds, because they would be equipped for the layers and layers and layers. Yeah. And like a big buzzword in the English language arts education world is literary merit. Does something have literary merit? And I would, I would venture to say that sometimes when we are bringing up like YA, legitimate YA texts, that's the question that gets asked. Well, how do you know it has literary merit? Blah, blah. And that's the voice that they say.
That is the voice.
That's the voice. There is no question to the merit and to the layers in this novel. And so I can see 12th graders. I can see some 11th graders in like an AP Lit course just devouring, because the contemporary voice is really what's starting to have the heaviest push in like our advanced placement courses and the higher level. And so, yes, it's like you were saying, it's definitely for an adult mind or an adult level, but I can see where young people can access that. It's just a reach.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's okay. I mean, I have to think that my readers will grow up one day, especially my readers in classrooms, right? My readers who are not already adults. And so it's nice to know that there will be an offering for them, and that there are excerpts for 11th and 12th graders to really maybe double down after they've read some other things and see, especially talking about revision or talking about voice or talking about growth. Like, here's how my voice continues to challenge itself in how I write and what I'm making. And I think that those real examples for young people is super helpful to kind of see, like, oh, you don't stay the same. Like, the point is that your writing and your work and a writer's legacy moves in a different direction with everything that they add, you know, to their canon, to their individual canon.
And so,
So I think it's really exciting to offer this kind of book.
Well, and I think really too, cool. One of the questions I really wanted to talk to you about was, so for those of you who are listening to us talk about Family Lore that haven't read it yet, or are just getting your hands on it, I would put Family Lore, to me, I got, vibes is what the kids are saying. I got a lot of like homegoing vibes. I like this idea of like jumping with generations and points of view and like the way that multiple family stories and cultural stories are woven together. I loved that, like the fabric of your story and the structure. So I think too, that's one thing we talk about craft. I would love for you to talk to us a little bit about the craft, especially in this novel, and like your approach to structure and storytelling. My really like poignant question was going to be, which was your favorite part, writing the words on the page or choosing how they're put together, and especially with Family Lore in mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are someone who, and maybe no one does this but me, but if you're someone who really looks at my work and you're kind of like, what is Elizabeth Acevedo's overall project, book from book from book? You'll see, like, you know, The Poet X is an individual story, like written almost as a journal entry, one character, one voice in verse. And then I pushed myself to write in prose. And then I pushed myself to write in verse again from two point of views. And now it's multiple point of views, past and present, memory leaps. Like, I think I'm constantly just, what is the next ambitious thing that is going to force me to stretch, right? And on a structural level, family lore's drop into memory and playing on memory. How do we think of memory? You're in the middle of doing something and it's just like you return it. You are transported. How do I transport a reader back and forth time and time again with these different women? And I am someone who is really paying attention to language. I am by no means a plotter, right? Like, if you come to my work and you're like, I want a big twist and I want it to read really linearly, and I really hope that like the entire thing has these kinds of beats, like, that's not what I'm doing, right? Like, I tell stories about women that are messy, that are honest, that show a lot of hurt and a lot of heart, and show the ways that we heal each other and heal ourselves and each possess a little bit of magic, right? And I think this book is the most spot on in terms of that, right? Magic and hurt and healing. And it's also the biggest, right? In terms of, here's a very loose plot. There's a wake happening. This woman is throwing her wake. We don't know why. And here are a lot of memories that they are all working through as that date approaches, right? And so I think for me, it was tough to kind of think through, not everyone's arc is going to be able to be a clean cut, you know, the typical, what we think of the climax and then the denouement, like that's not going to happen here. And so who is going to be a very clear, massive change? And I would say, I think for me, Matilde has... Right, the dancer, the one without any magic, supposedly, felt the clearest in terms of how shy and how people pleasing she is, and who she has to become by the end of the book in order to be herself. And then there are stories like Yadi's, who the love of her life, of her young life, comes back in the middle of all of this planning.
Oh my God. Yes.
After being imprisoned for, you know, close to two decades. And what do you do with that? What do you do with, I tried to move on and I'm not sure I did. And you were kind of in literally in arrested development.
Yeah.
Right. And now I have to do something about that. I have to respond to that stimulus.
Right.
And like, and I'm in a very anxious individual who like actually cannot process big feelings like this. And so then I had to be mindful of how much work can she do in 3 days? How much can her art? So maybe there are things here that are going to have to remain, you know, I can't make it a fairy tale. And I can't do that with everybody.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so Amanda, to your point, I think that those kinds of choices were really exciting and also really difficult to figure out, you know, how does satisfaction for a reader work?
Yeah.
And where am I willing to be like, oh, this is going to be a little unsatisfying. Sorry. but like, hopefully the other things are satisfying.
Yes. But I mean, speaking strictly as a reader, not like teacher hat gone, strictly as a reader, I will say that those things that might appear unsatisfying are to me like so authentic. So I'm a mom of two. My brain works in fragments and fragments of fragments. And so reading through a character story and being interrupted by memory and being interrupted by
another memory
comment to memory, and then having somebody and then coming back to the present moment. That's how I like make toast in the morning, right? Like that's it.
We literally didn't even talk about the asides, that there are asides in the middle of all of this.
And that's and you're like, who is it? Coffee is brewing, and I'm like, I remember this one time in elementary school. And then my daughter wakes up, and then something else happens. And then 2 hours later, I come back, and my coffee's cold, and then I'm back in the present moment, right? Like, that's how it works. And so to me, that just, it rings so true, and it makes me feel seen and less like a crazy person.
Yeah. And how do we mimic that kind of storytelling? I think that's really cultural too, right? We're so familiar with one particular kind of movement in American literature and how a story has to be told. And then you come from communities that tell stories within stories within stories in order to get at the end. And then you're like, and what was the point? And it's like, oh, who said there was a point? Like, I was just telling you a story, right? Or I was just getting here, or like, or, you know, if you can't figure it out from the allegory. And so it's, for me, it was also Dominicans talk in a particular way. We tell stories in a particular way. You're halfway through the story. And then they're like, oh, actually, I got to go back 50 years before I could tell this next part so you can understand everything I just told you. And you're like, okay, right? So that there was a little bit of, you know, what would oral storytelling look like in this book? Yes. And when you figure out that there is a part of the project, right? The reason there's a first person is that there is an oral storytelling component happening. There is a back and forth and an interruption that is at play. So I'm glad that, you know, you honed in on that. There's a lot of fun things in this book that I feel like I was, you know, trying to play with.
It's both the challenge and the delight, because then when you are able as a reader to fall and you go, oh, I love Yachty. Like, I mean, that was me. Yeah. I was like, oh, I love her. And to feel all of those layers of the different women in her family. And yes, the men in her family, but especially the layers of generations. And it's just, it was very rewarding once I like was able to turn my brain back on and be like a real, real hard reader. It took a minute.
No, that's
like,
real.
I'm not going to lie. That's real. When your life is reading children's books to a first grader and then reading through student work going, is this AI or is this the kid? Is this AI or is this the kid? The treat of getting into the meat of family lore. I was like, oh, this is wonderful.
It was so fun. And I can say too that I think that what you're saying about like cultural storytelling, this is something that I don't and haven't seen often, dare I say, at all. I mean, I know like I've taught and I love Julia Alvarez. I know she had a little blurb on your cover, and
she's the best.
One of my early love affairs was In the Time of the Butterflies, and I loved having the points of view. But I do love that you've taken this challenge of not just point of view, but like the asides. Oh my gosh, they became some of my favorite little nuggets that I don't know. I loved those nuggets, and I loved that structure piece. Like, that's kind of another piece of what I wanted to know is, how did you decide like placing those words on the page? How did you get there? How did that become like, okay, so I need to physically move this memory into this place? And did you mess around with it? Did you test it out with people, or did you just do it?
Yeah. The way the book came to be was, it's an odd assortment of choices, right? So in 2020, it would have been May of 2020, my friends and I, Clint Smith and Safiya Hillel, started a writer's group. Mm-hmm. And we would meet every Friday on Zoom. And you have to imagine, this is the thick of the scariest parts of the pandemic, where no one really knows what's happening. We're all kind of in lockdown. And I think we kind of needed writing community. And so we would meet up every Friday and submit pages the day before, read them, and then just comment on them. And I started playing around. I had been writing family lore on and off, little pieces, but this was what really got me going. And it was kind of what they pointed out that was interesting. So I started offsetting text to the right because I wanted it to feel like you fall into the memory. It's like this physical, the eye
is moving across the way it does with prose, and then there's a blank space and you're falling into a new kind of text. And I wanted to, you know, in the way that a poet would, indicate there's something visually happening on the page that is going to lead you to the fact that we are now somewhere else. In the way that I think deep memory, not like, mm-hmm. oh, yesterday this happened, but when you're in the middle of cooking and you're like, oh, my mom used to cut tomatoes this way, I remember, you know, like, and you're now in deep memory, mm-hmm. the brain is doing something. It is jumping off of a little, like, right now cliff into, you know, this new thing. And you know what you're doing. You're still physically there, but you're also somewhere else, right? So I wanted that very physical, visual aspect to it. And I remember Safia, one thing I did, and you would see this with poems, right, where the title becomes the first line. And so she kind of pointed out I had done it with a character where the character's name was at the top of the page. And she's like, you should just do this with every section where the character's name is what starts the first sentence. And so I was always very firmly planted in the character that I was writing because their name was the first thing that I had to indicate. So then when the I comes, you're kind of like, oh, this is who has been writing these asides. And Ona, who is the character, and I guess, I don't think this is a spoiler, but Ona, who has been writing the asides that you see very early on, is an anthropologist. And initially when I was writing, there were like 15 abstracts. So you were seeing pieces of essays, research that she was doing. It didn't work.
Okay.
If you've read The Poet X, you'll see that Siomara has first drafts and then final drafts of what she turns in. And they're always very different. Her first drafts are very vulnerable. They're told in poetry. And then her, you know, what she turns in is always like a stripped down, cut and dry. Here's what my teacher wants to read. Right. That was a happy accident. In all of my books, that then became a thing. With Imani Santiago, she'll be in the midst of her story. And then there's this kind of more broad view. Let me tell you about my city. Mm-hmm. And then it's just like a two pager on Philadelphia that kind of relates, but doesn't really relate. So I always have what I think of as my windows into a different doorway of the story that adds, but is not a part of the linear storytelling. So with Family Lore, I knew I wanted this window, but the abstract wasn't it. It just felt too disruptive. I know that some authors use footnotes. I'm thinking here of Juno Diaz. I know Nana Kwame Adegbenye in his last novel, Chain Gang All-Stars, has footnotes. That didn't feel quite it for me. I wanted her voice in the text. I wanted it to kind of be in the mix. And so we got these kinds of asides where she is, you know, you would imagine she is interviewing and then she is transcribing the interview and has to kind of disrupt the interview to say, oh, by the way, you know, children getting loaned to family members for years is actually really common and wasn't considered abandonment. But also these children weren't always loved or taken care of in the way that we imagined. Like, you know, Ona out. And then the story continues. And so that felt honest to me. And it was a way to allow, especially because, you know, you have a 70-year-old, there are comments that she might make about certain things, having someone able to come in and say, you know, we didn't talk about postpartum depression back then, but I think that this might be some, you know, this might be something that I'm now seeing as I'm doing these interviews, and then steps out. It allows a contextualization of this other voice that is holding all of the story for us that felt, I guess, even more compelling than the abstracts would have. But it's the windows for me. You're going to see it in all my writing. I like the idea of windows. Clap When You Land didn't have it as much. The only like cool feature in Clap When You Land is that you're counting the days differently. It's just like, you know, this many days after the crash, this many days. And then you can go in the past 4,000 days ago. So there's like this play there. But you'll see in the other books that I kind of have these little nooks and crannies that I want to invite readers into, that where you step away from the main plot and the main storytelling to come somewhere else. And I think for readers who are really into it, they kind of enjoy looking into the little corners.
It is fun because it's like you get to peer around the side. Yeah. Like, so it's like I kind of imagine it where it's like when you were talking about the eye following on the page, it's like going through the looking glass, right? And you're like going through, but as you fall down, you can still see your way out. And so you pop back out sometimes. But then as you're still going down, you see all these little frames and pieces of it that are still connected, but give you just more. Like, it just gives you more. I like it. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of windows, actually, when we talk about literature and we talk about bringing our students, especially perspectives that are going to be windows and mirrors and even doors into different voices and different ideas, those windows are going to bring them into, you know, other experiences and let them experience through the eyes of a different character or another culture, another, just a different group of people versus mirrors that let them see themselves reflected. I'm going to venture to guess, because of the characters that you create, are these characters that you saw growing up, or are these characters that you wish you had seen growing up? And kind of what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think with fiction, for me, it's a combination of both. All the main characters are characters that I know and knew, right? Siomara, Imani, Yahaira. I would say Camino's a little bit more invented, mainly because I've not lived in the Dominican Republic. And because her, you know, what she deals with a stalker, I for sure have seen that firsthand. What she deals with in terms of the dire need to figure out how to not be recruited into sex work required her to be a particular kind of character that could grapple with that and not let it be so overwhelming or drown her or enticing, right? Which it could be. And so she had to be fully invented. But even she, you know, I did work with an organization, a community organization in Sosua that, you know, worked with a lot of young women who were trying to be, who were recruited, or there were attempts at recruiting. And so you got to know these young women and what kept them, you know, walking miles to go to high school, despite being told there's an easier way to make money, you know, at 15, 16, 14. Right. And so even Camino is drawn from knowing young women who were trying to help themselves and their families and the many different choices that they had to make and what that could look like. Right. And there are all kinds of choices that folks have to make. And that's just the truth of it. But I will say that some of the surrounding cast, that's where you'll see my imagination on, like, here's who I wish would have held me. Here's who I wish would have held the teen mothers that I knew, both as students, as classmates. My mother was a childcare provider, as the women that she took care of their babies. And they were, you know, 15, 16 in high school trying to take care of themselves. And so that's where I get to be really playful around. Here's how we can show up as community members when these kinds of young people are in our orbit, right? And so Galeano, the teacher who I adore, was based, you know, on teachers that I loved and had who were so encouraging of my voice and my poetry. And she also goes above and beyond, right, in ways that I would hope a teacher could and would. That when I was a teacher, I wish I could have been, you know, Galeano. I think she's just so giving. And we see that with the Fire on High, you know, with her advisor. She also has someone that she's just so enamored with and who loves her back and really wants the best for her. And so those best friends, for me, you're always going to find just the best friends. I don't do best friend drama. That's for other writers. For me, the best friend is nothing but, like, always the soft spot to turn to in all of my books. And so there is that little bit of, here's where I make up the world we need and an example of the world we need. But the main characters, I think, are very much drawn from real life.
And it reads true in, like you were saying earlier, in the care and the just attention that you give to your readers with just the softness and the care that comes through with, like, real life things. It's not like you're washing over or glossing over life in your books. It's definitely like life is happening to your characters, but there's a tenderness that it's exactly what you're describing. It's that the world that we need, right? When life happens, it's the world that kids need and that the reader needs. And okay, so let's get into a little bit more of the readers. I feel like we've talked quite a bit about what a student or, like, a younger reader can get. You know what? But actually, I'm going to leave this question pretty open. I guarantee many people listening are going to be picking up, like, if anybody has not yet read The Poet X, Clap A New Land, With The Fire On High, they're going to be picking those up, but especially Family Lore. those readers, what do you hope that they walk away with by the last page of any given book, or maybe just Family Lore in particular? What do you want them to walk away with?
I think there's a couple of things I tried to imbue in all of my work, but I would say Family Lore in particular, it's never too late to find your purpose. There is something important about living well and dying well. And being really thoughtful of, like, what do I want to leave behind? How do I want to transition? And what does it mean to receive your flowers while you're here? What does it mean to give people their flowers while they're here? How do we hold each other and love each other and hold ourselves and love ourselves for whatever time this earth escapade exists, right? Because I do think there's another transition and another adventure. And I think you see that in Family Lore, right? There is a before and there is an after. And this mm-hmm. is one piece of that. But how do we enjoy and love and treat this during, so that when after comes, we're ready, if ever there is a ready.
Yeah, I love that. That's lovely. Well, thank you. Thank you for spending your time with us. Thank you for your just incredible thoughtfulness. We appreciate you. We appreciate your work and what you are bringing to the world and to our students and listeners. We are going to be continuing this conversation at Happy Hour. So if you're a member of Happy Hour, just get ready, because we are going to get even a little bit more into the weeds. But thank you again. Really quick, before we go, where can our listeners find you and find your work and follow along with you?
My website, Acevedo, A-C-E-V-E-D-O, writes, W-R-I-T-E-S, is where you'll get updates on whether or not I'm coming to your city, whether I'm doing virtual events, and the latest news. And the only social media I'm active on is Instagram under the same name, Acevedo Writes.
Perfect. And we'll have that all linked in the show notes for this episode. We so appreciate you. Thank you so much. And Happy Hour members, make sure that you are listening in, because that episode is coming tomorrow. All right. We'll see you next time.
Bye. Bye. Take care.
Thanks again for listening to Brave New Teaching.
We'd love to keep the conversation going over on Instagram.
And while you're there, check out the links in our bio for the most up-to-date events going on in the Brave New Teaching community.
Thanks for being here, and have a great week at school.